Are you ready to become a better version of yourself, to become a leader in your personal and professional life? Then welcome to the CJ Evolution Podcast, where we put a twist on traditional criminal justice professions and provide you with the tools you need to set yourself up for success in your career and for the future. Now, welcome your host, the CJ Evolutionist himself, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Episode 244 of the CJE podcast. I just made that up. The Criminal Justice Evolution podcast. Whatever you're doing, wherever you are at, thank you for tuning in. Special thanks to all those first responders out there. Brave men and women doing a very difficult job in a very difficult environment. Thank you. You have much support. Don't listen to the naysayers. You got a ton of support out there. Keep doing a fantastic job. We continue to grow because of you, the listener. Thank you so much. If you have a moment, head over to iTunes, rate and review my podcast. I sure would appreciate it. I am super excited to be partnered with Four Sigmatic, an amazing coffee company. For all you coffee lovers out there, you're going to love their products, I'm telling you. Most notably, their Lion's Mane Mushroom Coffee. I said mushrooms. It doesn't taste like mushrooms. You're going to love it. And they also have coffees and elixirs and mochas that you're going to love. If you head over to cgevolution.com, you're going to get 15% off of your point of sale by using the promo code CJEVO. You know, this next guest you're going to love, he's an expert in personal safety as well as organizational safety. He travels all around the world bringing safety and security onto the forefront of people's minds. He's also an ex-police officer with many years of great experience. So grab a pen and paper. If you don't want to do that, grab your laptop out. Take some notes. You're going to love this next guest. Enjoy. All right, everybody, welcome back. Super excited to have Dr. Stephen Albrecht on the show. If you don't know who he is, he's a trainer, speaker, author and consultant. He's an expert in a variety of topics, most recognized for his expertise in high-risk HR issues, safety issues. He's also a retired police officer. Are you there, sir?
I am. Thanks, Patrick.
Well, thank you for being here. And Steve is in Colorado, too, fellow Coloradoan. He's down in the Colorado Springs. How's the weather? I mean, it's beautiful here where I'm at.
It's pretty nice. I took the dogs out for a run today. It was great. And I'm just looking for a peaceful winter, hopefully.
Yeah. I don't know about that. We got hammered, you know. I don't know if you got hit with that big snowstorm. Did you guys get hit down there a couple weeks ago?
We did, and it wasn't too bad. But, you know, the big part about the summer, as you know, is the hail. That was the hammer.
Oh, geez. Yeah, we had we got hit so hard. I know everybody down in the Springs got just demolished down there. It's just crazy, I mean, how the weather is changing. Well, Steve, again, I know you're very, very busy. Thank you for being here. Did I miss anything in that bio? You want to fill in any blanks?
No, I've got a pretty interesting career in terms of the workplace violence and school violence prevention work. And that really started when I was in the academy in 1984. In San Diego, a guy went into the McDonald's in July of 1984. He killed 21 people at a McDonald's in San Ysidro, which is the last San Diego city before you cross into Mexico.
Jesus.
And that was the worst mass murder in the history of the United States. And it happened in my city. And I was 21 years old. I was in the academy. I was all buffed out. I thought I was going to take on the world. Mm-hmm. That was the worst thing I ever saw in my police career, and all I looked at was the Polaroid photographs. I know you remember Polaroids back then.
Yeah.
So the homicide guys came into the academy and said, "Here, fellas, look at 110 pictures of dead little kids and their parents eating their Happy Meals," and it was just brutal.
Oh, Jesus.
And I remember, you know, that sort of imprinted for me. And then also the reason I became a cop was I got robbed. I was 15 years old. I worked at a grocery store in San Diego right by my parents' house. It's still there. It's a little teeny kind of a milk store drive-through place where you drove in and got milk and eggs and bread and whatnot. And two guys with guns came in and grabbed me, grabbed my partner, threw us on the ground. The guy put a .357 in the back of my skull and said, "Give me the keys to the safe." And I was 15. And I said, "If I survive this, I'm going to go be a cop." I was going to be a baseball player. That was my plan. I said, "I'm going to lift some weights. I'm going to do some push-ups. I'm going to drink some protein shakes. I'm going to go be a cop." And that's what I did. I worked there for six more years. When I got out of college, I went straight in the academy.
And you obviously wanted to help people. I mean, it wasn't just that the sole reason that you guys got robbed. I mean, you wanted to help people, right? Like most cops do.
Yeah, and also I thought, you know, and you know this from your work, I don't want anybody ever to get the tactical advantage on me. And so I knew in that situation where I felt helpless, and I can imagine what other people felt like as crime victims in their world. I didn't want to feel helpless like that. And I think also it may have helped me in terms of my empathy, especially for robbery victims. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was in patrol in San Diego, a lot of guys were like, "Yeah, what'd he take? Okay, what'd he look like? And how big was the gun? Blah, blah, blah." And I would go and sit down with them and say, "Do you want me to call anybody? And, you know, do you want me to get your parents here or your store manager? Or, you know, can I do anything for you?" Because I was empathetic to the issue having gone through it.
Yeah. Yeah. You weren't just a report taker like so many cops out there. You actually got involved and you showed some empathy and you actually connected with people.
So being exposed to workplace violence, both as a robbery victim and seeing the McDonald's massacre, you know, photos really turned me towards that subject. And then in 1992, a guy killed two people at work in San Diego at General Dynamics at the missile plant in San Diego. So I went to the prison, I interviewed him, and I said, "Why'd you do that?" And he told me, and that became sort of the centerpiece for the book that I wrote with the police psychologist at the time, whose name was Michael Mantel. Mm-hmm. The book was called Ticking Bombs, and Mantel was the guy that did the debrief for all the first responders at the McDonald's massacre. And you and I have talked about the importance of debriefing for cops in stress situations.
Mm-hmm. So you did, you know, what else did you do when you were in law enforcement? You were a sergeant, right, when you got out?
Yeah, I worked in patrol, and then I worked as a domestic violence investigator. And that was also a sort of a key to my work as seeing the crossover from domestic violence from home to work. And you know this, that most domestic violence victims work. And so, you know, you can tell a victim to change her hair color and paint her car and get a new apartment and change her telephone number, but she's still going to be at her place of work 8 to 10 hours a day. And that's where these perpetrators would show up to attack them. Mm-hmm. So I really started to see the workplace violence, school violence, domestic violence kind of connection to the work that I was doing based on, you know, being a DV detective.
Mm-hmm. And at what point did you say, Steve, you know, hey, I'm kind of done with law enforcement. You know, you did your duty, you served honorably, but at what point did you say, you know, I'm going to go and do some other stuff?
Well, I went to graduate school in 95 and 96. And when I got my master's in 96, I started working in security, you know, subjects and doing some teaching on the side and doing things related to security management. I got my doctoral degree in 2000, and I said, I want to spin off. And that's when I left the PD. I want to spin off and work full time as a trainer and consultant for security issues, because the big driver for me for that was Columbine. Mm-hmm. So Columbine was really kind of flipped a switch for a lot of cops in the United States in terms of our tactical response. And so April 99, I'm like, I'm going to go do workplace violence full time. And that's what I did soon afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you miss the job?
Well, you know, I'm sure you think this way, too. I miss my partners and the people that I worked with. I don't miss the work that much. I could do it, I think, you know, in if you stuck me in a patrol car, I'd do okay with all the gizmos and things that are in there now. But I really think that the job, and you know from your experience, can be really a burnout for especially people in patrol. And I, you know, I was always a big fan of job rotation and different things. If you could go to different investigative assignments or come back to work in patrol with kind of a fresh perspective, because, you know, I mean, my best friend on the PD worked in patrol for almost 30 years. And I mean, it took its toll on him.
Yeah. And we talked a little bit about off the air, Steve, about, you know, I mean, officers taking better care of themselves and stress management, which you talk a lot about. Why is this such an issue with so many agencies where we're not doing, and I'm a senior administrator, I have a responsibility too with this, but it seems like we're not doing enough to take care of our officers.
I think the evolution, and you have seen this in your work, I'm sure, has really kind of improved, because, you know, in our old days, it was like, you know, going back 35 years for me, it was like that's all that touchy-feely stress management stuff.
Yeah, we're not going to talk about that shit. That's not tough.
We're not real, you know, real cops go home and drink, or they go shoot guns at the range. And I'm what I really figured out after a long time of seeing agencies around the country is, you know, the stress response, stress management, and the wellness piece was sort of haphazard. I mean, some really effective in some agencies and not so much in others. And, you know, we've seen so much suicidality with cops, which is such a surprise to the public. They just don't think that cops commit suicide to the level that they do. Mm-hmm. And the level of depression and job burnout and just being exposed to the baddest and maddest and saddest that society has to offer, I really think, you know, these days we're seeing much more of a wellness orientation. I know NYPD has a huge wellness chunk in their academy, and I think we're bringing back, you know, when we bring back new sergeants and train them, we're exposing them to the concept of paying attention to their cops and looking at the wellness. And one of the things I did in as a consultant, you know, as a civilian for the PD in San Diego, is we worked on a thing called the Early Identification and Intervention System, or EIIS. Mm-hmm. And EIIS systems are really designed really kind of in the post-Rodney King riots and kind of a thing where we're looking at cop behavior and looking at use of force, but also things related to wellness where, you know, we developed a set of criteria, at least in San Diego, about 15 different things that, you know, if we saw cops that were overexposed to those issues, you know, like one of the things we measured was death calls and the other one was high-risk violence calls. And then police equipment accidents and police equipment shootings and missing cord and failing to go to the range. And those are all sort of indicators of stress. Mm-hmm. And so you go, you know, and you know this, and if you look at your agency, you say, I bet I could guess if I had 15 or so criteria, there'd be two or three cops that would show up at the top of the list. Mm-hmm. In terms of these things. And you know, some cops are just crap magnets. They get all the horrible calls.
Yeah.
You could go your entire career without getting, you know, a sexual assault of a child, and some guy will get three of them in 2 weeks, or, you know, a dead baby or something like that. And then we looked at the exposure to those cops to, you know, a variety of different things. And police equipment accidents means they're not paying attention when they're driving. And you know, missing cord and lots of sick time and things like that. Those are all indicators. And it wasn't profiling. And that's what we had to sell the POAs. We're not profiling these guys and these ladies. We were looking at risk factors.
Yeah, we're trying to take care of them.
Exactly. And so then when we would grab them and say, you know, let's have a coaching conversation. And literally in San Diego, we created a list of about 65 different resources, chaplains and rabbis and priests and you know, wellness type of activities and gym memberships and Alcoholics Anonymous. We have an actual Alcoholics Anonymous chapter inside the PD, which is run by, you know, recovering alcoholic cops, in which we referred people to those things and said, look, this is not about your career. It's about your life. Can we focus on your career second and your life first? That's what we really care about. And we had good success with that program.
Yeah. And it's such great stuff that you're doing, Steve. I just think it's such, you know, it's so hard to get over those hurdles. Like, I'm not going to talk to anybody. That's people look down on me. You know, and people won't think I'm a good cop if I say, look, I need help.
And the part, I think you may have seen this in your career too, is how many times do you uncover the myths and the falsehoods about things like employee assistance program and counseling services. And I tell people, you know, I had some PTSD issues. I went to counseling. It was very helpful to me. It was helpful for my relationship. And I look and say, you know, I still talk to cops in this day and age who don't think that you know, counseling system is confidential, which it is. They think there's some sort of report that's going to land on your desk and you're going to review it as you come up to promotion time for them, which is totally wrong. And the idea that we want to focus on the total officer rather than just the one that does the job for us. And I think, you know, there's a stigma, which especially a lot of older cops, and this drives me crazy, especially I talk about it in training, older cops sort of blow it for younger cops by going, that's for wussies and, you know, real men drink and all the other stuff that people say. And, you know, big girls don't cry, big boys don't cry. And as a result, we have people that are in dire need, but have been talked into the, you know, not getting help because of some veteran officer gave them bad information.
Yeah, it's just horrible. Now, we talked off the air. I am a huge fan, and I know you are, about meditation, Steve. Why can't we get this implemented more in law enforcement agencies?
You know, a guy that I consider sort of a friend is named Dan Harris, and Dan Harris is the host of Nightline on ABC. Mm-hmm. And Dan Harris has a really cool podcast called 10% Happier, and he has a really cool app called 10% Happier based on a book that he wrote, not surprisingly, called 10% Happier. And Harris was a sort of a skeptic to meditation. He says, I'm a fidgety guy, high energy guy. He had a panic attack on the air one night on ABC News, and he said, I got to get a handle on this, and he started meditating. And so he has actually, and I think the woman he interviewed was the Tempe, Arizona police chief, and she said, we teach this to our cops, and we give them time to do meditation as part of their wellness work and their physical fitness and thing, and we think it's important. So I have seen around the country, you know, to my, you know, delight and surprise, that some police agencies have said, this is not woo-woo, it's not, you know, shave your head and move to Nepal stuff. It's about it's about centering. And, you know, I teach meditation to cops all the time. I teach stress management to city and county government. And I tell people, you know, what do the IT guys tell you if there's a problem with your laptop or your tablet or your phone or your computer? Well, they always say, reboot it. Mm-hmm. And I say meditation, whether it's 15 or 10 minutes or whatever, is simply rebooting your head.
Yeah.
And for me, exactly. You know, for cops, I also give them sort of a tactical approach, which is spend the time in a relaxed state thinking about doing your job successfully, being good at your job out in the field and future pacing and what one of my pals calls tactical daydreaming, which is you put yourself in a success position and say, you know, if bad guy does this, then I'm going to do this in response. And as I respond to the call, I'm going to have, you know, my head on a swivel and I'm going to see everything I need to see and use the meditative approach as a way to skill.
Mm-hmm. And I think, too, and I don't know what your thoughts are, Steve, I have an idea, but surrounding ourselves with the right people. I mean, I know it's hard sometimes, and I'm not trying to come down on officers, but, you know, we work in a negative environment, you know that. But I think we need to have friends outside of law enforcement, too.
I think that's a great point, and I learned that a long time ago. Someone said to me, you know, in sort of my new part of my career, hang out with people that aren't cops, that like and love you for not being a cop.
Exactly.
And hang out with people that have interest in things that have nothing to do with law enforcement, so you enjoy life. And, you know, one of the things I sort of got at the end of my career was, you know, I fell into the standard trap that cops do, which is everybody's a jerk except cops, You know, everybody's an a-hole except cops and my family. And, you know, and that's not the way the world should be. The idea that you say, I can take joy out of, you know, doing stuff with my kids and watching them play soccer and all this stuff. And instead of saying, you know, I have to sort of compartmentalize my life and the world is, you know, jerks on one side and only cops on the other. Mm-hmm. And I think the idea of seeing other people for what they can come to you as friendships and, you know, and relationships and like and love you for not being a cop is awesome.
Yeah. It took me a long time. It sounds like we had some of the same experiences. It took me a long time to realize that majority of people out there are good people. I mean, that's just my bill. Maybe I'm just naive after all these years, but it took me a long time to realize through meditation and kind of changing my environment a little bit as far as it's not that I don't love cops. I love cops, but getting friends outside of law enforcement at big influences was my when I got married again. I got divorced, got married again, and my new wife didn't have anything to do with law enforcement. And then I started becoming friends with her friends, and I started realizing, yeah, not everybody out there is a criminal. It's amazing.
Yeah, and it's great because you're right. And when you look at the world that cops deal with, I mean, you know, the statistically, most of the crime and stuff is done by a small number of people doing it over and over again. So it's, you know, the 80-20 rule of life is, you know, 20% of the crooks commit 80% of the crime. Yeah. I think that's true. And you look at the revolving door we have between arrests and prosecution and whatnot. And you go, you know, a lot of what we do in law enforcement is armed social work.
Yeah.
We're trying to help people, but we also have, there's a small percentage of people that need to go to jail. And those folks, you know, if you lock up one heroin addict that's stealing, you know, $1,000 worth of stuff a day to feed his $100 a day habit, that's an enormous impact on the community. And that one guy, you know, he doesn't represent the entire community, but he sure has an impact on it.
I want to get into your book, your new book, but really quick, what do you think of the state of policing today, Steve? We you know, we're both in law enforcement. You were in law enforcement a long time. I'm currently in it. And maybe that's kind of a too broad of a question to ask you. But a lot of things have changed since you got into law enforcement, since I got into law enforcement. I mean, what do you think the tone out there is? You still got your finger in it. I mean, you still talk to plenty of cops out there.
Yeah, and I write for Police Magazine and places like that. And I have kind of a feel for things from the outside. I guess on a positive and negative, I guess the one negative I see is that I think that cops are too much focused on gizmos. Mm-hmm. And so when I left the field around 2000, we were just getting tasers. And then once everybody got tasers, then that became the answer for everything in law enforcement. The guy gives you a little crap in the street, you taser him. You know, the guy mouths off a little bit in a drunk driving arrest, you taser him. And so what I saw was a lot of, you know, we moved away, I think, negatively in law enforcement from talking to people and also talking people into handcuffs and de-escalating situations with our words. And then they just said, hey, if the guy gives you a little crap, just taser him. I think that was one sort of wrong direction thing. And then the other part is I really feel for cops out in the field because of the public scrutiny and the media. Mm-hmm. So everybody now is an expert on law enforcement because they have a camera and they can take pictures of the cops doing their thing. And oftentimes they don't get the entire context of the contact with this person. They go, why are they arresting that poor homeless guy? And what they didn't see 15 minutes ago was that poor homeless guy was pointing a knife at somebody and was running into traffic trying to stab folks. They didn't see that part. Mm-hmm. They just saw, you know, a pile of cops on top of the poor homeless guy.
Yeah.
So a lot of stuff now because of the you know, the digital age that people live in and the fact that they want to post stuff. I really feel it's difficult to be a cop. And I like the idea of cameras on cops. And I really think, you know, that's what we had to do in this country to really ramp up our accountability and also to prove to people that the vast majority of time the cops are doing the right thing.
Exactly. And I'm a big proponent of body cams, like you indicated. And I teach and talk to people a lot. And one of the things, getting back to, you know, kind of people tend to judge at first glance, or, you know, the first, you know, you're on YouTube and you see a video. But I always tell students, and maybe you've heard this before, is, you know, think of a football game, NFL game. You know, a receiver catches a ball, and, you know, the issue is whether or not he had his foot in or not. I mean, how many angles do you get of that? We don't get that in law enforcement.
Yeah. 19 ways to look at it, and they can go back and review it 43 times. And in law enforcement, you know, as you know, I always tell people how often things go from shoot to don't shoot to shoot to don't shoot to don't to you know, shoot again in a fraction of a second. And then you go, the cop did what he thought or she thought that they could do in that situation. And a fraction of a second later, you know, the guy may have turned his body as if he was not, you know, pointing a gun directly at them. And people misread that all the time. Mm-hmm. So I like, you know, fat systems where we put cops through simulators, and then we take some, you know, kind of loudmouths in the community and these sort of community activists that want to stir things up, and we put them through the simulators, and they come out and they go, oh my God, I didn't realize how hard it was. You know, and they come out shaky and sweaty, and they go, wow, this was, you know, this was really eye opening to me, and it really changes their perspective.
Yeah, Yeah. You talk a lot about leadership, Steve. I mean, what do you think some of the key attributes, whether you're in the private sector or the public sector, what do you think some of the key attributes of successful leaders are?
It's really quite a difference I see in the public sector versus the private sector. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I see much less patience for employees in the private sector. I mean, if you're a screw up, they cut you loose. And in the public sector, you know, we have, you know, coaching and counseling and progressive discipline, and oftentimes union situations and issues where they're given an opportunity to rescue their careers. And I really see, especially in the private sector clients that I have, there's not a lot of patience for the intensity and the you know, deadlines and the skill that's required to do work. Whereas in the public sector, we grow people, we give them a chance to develop, we are corrective in our leadership style to them, to their benefit. So I there's a huge difference, I think, in public sector versus private sector. Yeah. Not patience in the private sector for employees that aren't pulling their weight.
Yeah, you hit it on the head, and that's a great point, because you've seen it and I've seen it where exactly, the screw-up employee, you know, gets chance after chance after chance in a public organization. And maybe that's the right thing to do. And I know in a lot of cases there's unions that you have to deal with. But, you're exactly right. And I haven't obviously been in the private sector for a long time, but I imagine it's, hey, you're a screw-up, out of here.
It's funny, I was talking to a fire chief one time, and he said something which is so accurate. He said, we changed the culture around this fire department one retirement at a time. And you think about it, work, when somebody leaves, they quit or retire, and some people go, boy, we sure are glad that guy's gone. He was awful. Yeah. And then sometimes, like, boy, we really miss this person's connection and leadership and approach and how they did their job. And I find that in first responder culture a lot is, you know, some people leave and they go, oh my God, you know, actually things dramatically improve around here because this person was retired or left or quit. And then other times, like, wow, we really miss this person's contribution. So it's funny how that works, especially in first responder world.
Exactly. And you know, it's so hard to change culture sometimes.
Well, I think that, you know, I'm actually doing some work with a partner of mine who's a fire chief in California. We're putting together these webinars, and we're looking at the police culture versus the fire culture. And there are so many things that, you know, we do this because that's always the way we've done it. And sometimes to the negative, like hazing and pranks and stuff. You know, when I was in the cops, you know, they were pretty rough on trainees and, you know, going through the FTO program.
Oh, yeah.
You came out of that, you're like, man, these people don't like me. And it wasn't about that. It was just saying, we're trying to sort of toughen you up for this work that, you know, the academy gives you one sort of perspective. And then when you get out in the field, I remember someone said to me when I went to my first graveyard shift, you know, when I'd been on like 2 or 3 days out in the field, and they said, everybody you talk to, once the sun will go down, will have alcohol in their breath. And I said, no way. And they were right. Everybody I talked to had alcohol in their breath, you know, past 7 o'clock at night. And so I think there's a way to indoctrinate people into the fire and police culture. But you've seen, you know, with the Me Too movement, a lot of stuff infecting women and all that we can't do this hazing and all this other crap that we used to do just because that's the way we've always done it since the 50s or whatever. It just doesn't work.
Yeah. And I remember as a young officer, and you know, it was very tough, and you got hazed and stuff. And I remember one senior officer telling me one time, look, if they're not giving you shit, if they're not talking to you and hazing you, then something's wrong.
Well, and also, you know, it's like
didn't make it right, but something's
right.
Wrong.
But if you can't, and I get the point, which is if you can't handle this, then you're not gonna be able to handle the field.
Yeah.
And you know, people in the field want to hurt you, and at least in the academy environment, you know, we were connected with our training partners. You didn't drop your colleague on their head when you're doing defensive tactics drills and stuff like that. But out in the field, all bets are off, and the rules have changed. Yeah. And I guess that's the biggest thing, Patrick, for me is I really feel for officers out in the field now with a danger. And I think it's always been a dangerous job, but we see in the last couple of years these police ambushes. And these situations where, you know, one or two cops go to a call and they both get killed as soon as they get out of the car. I mean, that's what's really disturbing to me is how there's a cultural shift in this country where there's a small number of people that are just like, I'm shooting at the cops as soon as they get here, and I'll make a reason for them to come so I can kill them. And I think we're facing that worse than ever before.
Well, and I agree. And as you know, Steve, there's been, you know, I mean, you know, we have so many groups out there. Maybe not so many, but, you know, definitely a BLM movement. We have, you know, some other anti-law enforcement groups out there. And I think a lot of times now, and again, I just speak for my experiences, you know, cops are more reactive now. They're not that proactive anymore, and they're afraid. And again, I don't think this is the right mindset, but I, you know, talking to officers from a lot of different places, they're afraid to go out there and be proactive. They don't want to get sued.
I mean, the concept taken to an extreme is called depolicing, which
exactly.
I'll just sit in the car And I knew cops that did this at sort of the tail end of their career, and I kind of got it. You know, when I got ready to leave law enforcement, I had sort of, you know, whatever that Vietnam thing, which is you're afraid to go out on your last mission because you don't want to get killed. I was like, I just want to get through.
Retired on duty.
Exactly. So, but I knew a lot of cops that would just say, I'm going to sit in the car, I'm going to do my crossword puzzle, and I'm going to look at my phone, and I'll eat my lunch. Now, if you call me, I'm going to radio call, and I'll drive lights and siren to get to help another cop, or if there's an emergency situation, I'm certainly not going to dodge the work, but I will not be proactive in terms of field interviews and looking for people to talk to. I'm not going to go out trying to catch parolees or catch, you know, sex offenders, or I'm not going to go to a place where, you know, especially in parts of town where we're not too popular, I'm not going to really ramp up my activity because I just don't want to be filmed and second-guessed and argued with. And, you know, you step out of the car and 15 people are over there with their cameras. So that depolicing, I think, you know, because of Ferguson and, you know, sort of post-Rodney King and all the stuff that happened in law enforcement. And I'm not, you know, here to say that we haven't had some bad shootings in this. That happens. But the vast majority of these situations, and here's the part I never get, and maybe you hear this too, no cop shows up and says, I want to shoot somebody today. No cop gets out of the car and goes, I hope I get to shoot somebody. Every cop that I've ever worked with or met in my life goes, I hope it never comes to this. I'll defend my life and somebody else's life if I have to. But there's sort of a sense for people that, you know, we just sort of like to ride around gunning down people. And I hate when the media uses that phrase.
Well, why would anybody, Stephen, you know this, but for people out there listening, and I think the majority of people listening know this, I teach, you do too. But it amazes me, you know, when I talk to students, and some of them have that mindset. You mean to tell me, I get up in the morning, kiss my wife goodbye, have a big, beautiful house, have some nice cars, have some money in the bank. I'm going to say, you know what, I'm going to go kill somebody. I want to take all that. I want to risk it all. I want to risk my career, risk going to prison. It's just insane that people think that cops, maybe there are some out there, Steve. You know, maybe there are bad cops out there, like we've talked about. There's no doubt about it. There's some cops out there that need to get the hell out of the ranks. But the overwhelming majority of cops are just trying to do a very, very difficult job in a very difficult environment. Why would an officer, a rational person, not even an officer, why would somebody, you know, piss everything away, you know, and go out there with that mindset?
And not even the physical things that you could lose.
Exactly. Those are replaceable.
Just the psychological burden of carrying that around for the rest of your days, even, and you know from the people that you've talked to that have been in critical incidents, even if you did the exact right thing, I mean, the guy's a homicidal maniac, he shoots a bunch of people, and you get there and have to shoot him, you still have to carry around the fact that you took this person's life.
Exactly.
And I think because of the TV and movies and the sense that people have that they don't see cops, you know, in terms of the sort of flesh and blood kind of folks that they are, that it's like, oh, well, what's the big deal? You did what you had to do. And I'm like, I've talked to a lot of cops I knew have been in shootings. One of my friends worked on the border team, you know, which the book Lines and Shadows from Joseph Wambaugh was about. Mm-hmm. And one of my best friends on the department was shot in the neck and paralyzed. He got out of his car and walked up to some guy who was going to shoot his wife and kid and shot my friend Dan in the neck. And he's paralyzed. He's a quadriplegic. Jesus. And so you look at those situations and you go, you know, nobody signed on for that stuff. And I think what really drives me the most crazy, especially in terms of the news media coverage, is that we give the perpetrator a free pass on their behavior. You know, no cop would be there if the guy wasn't waving the gun around in the street. Mm-hmm. It's not like we just said, well, let's go pick on this guy. You know, everything, and I see this in like litigation when I look at, you know, how agencies are sued. It's like, well, how did we get there? We got there because Mr. So-and-so had a gun and standing in the street and he was firing it into houses. That's how we got there. Yeah. We didn't show up because we just, you know, wanted to mess with him that day. And that's, you know, whether it's the racial factor or whether there are issues that come in that somehow we're sort of profiling or targeting people, the perpetrator oftentimes gets a free pass for his behavior. We don't go back and say, this guy was the cause of all this stuff, the shootings, the ambulances, the lawsuits, all this was driven by this guy's activity.
Yeah, exactly. And I agree with you. We need to start talking about that a lot more. Now, you're the author of 20 books on a variety of topics in business and police topics. Can you talk about your recent book?
I wrote a book called Some People Are No Damn Good, and that's kind of a catchy title. My wife's grandfather was the fire chief of Tucson, and that was one of his favorite phrases, Some People Are No Damn Good.
Subtitle
on crime and crooks and cops, and it's on Amazon Kindle. Doing pretty well. Lots of good reviews for it. It's a collection of chapters about workplace violence and school violence and what we're doing and domestic violence and how certain things have gone badly for people and what really, and a lot of women seem to resonate with the book because there's a lot of stuff about keeping themselves safe, keeping your kids safe at school. So I just took about 50 chapters to write all the stuff I wanted to write about crooks I knew and cops that I knew and and things that have happened in our world, and especially in terms of workplace violence and school violence that we can learn from. There's some good humor in the book, too. I have a whole chapter, which you'd love, on police slang, which is the way that cops talk, which I think is hilarious. And then there's just a lot of stuff about sort of how you keep yourself safe, your kids safe at school, and kind of the world that we live in terms of you know, Patrick, there's a weird sort of stat that I use all the time. In the year 2000, we had one mass shooting in the United States. One guy in Massachusetts at a software company killed, I think, four or five people. And that was the only shooting of that type in the United States in the year 2000. Well, now fast forward to 2018, there's about 30 a year, 35 a year. I mean, Jesus. It's just ungodly how we've gone from one to 30 to 35 in that short of span of time.
That's great. Well, obviously, there's a mental health component out there to this. I mean, would you agree, Steve?
Yeah, and everybody likes to jump on the gun part, too. You and I know that we've always had guns, and we've always had mentally ill people. I think the biggest part is there's a sense of a small number of people have this enraged entitlement, which gives them the desire to go do these things. You have broken my heart. You fired me. You kicked me out of school. You interfered with my plan to stalk you or whatever happens to be. And so they go, I'm entitled to do these things. And I don't think we've had this entitlement culture like as we have it now. Mm-hmm. And also you throw in the news media coverage, which says if I do something horrific, I'm not going to be nationally famous. I'll be internationally famous, not for a good way. But everybody will know my name. The guy in Las Vegas that, you know, killed 58 people October 1st. Everybody knows who that guy is as a result of his deeds. And that's pretty enticing for a small number of people to want to do that stuff.
Well, look at the Aurora shooter, you know, James Holmes. It's crazy. Now, since you were talking about really quick, we were talking about, you know, security issues. I mean, what are some tips and suggestions, Steve, that you can give people out there, not in law enforcement maybe, but in terms of, you know, what can you give them as far as physical and personal security? How do people, I mean, I'm sure we could talk all day about this, but some quick tips on how people can take better care of themselves, you know, be more security conscious, you know what I mean? Not be paranoid, but be aware of your surroundings.
I mean, there's a couple things that really touch on that. One is, you know, Colonel Jeff Cooper, he runs back in the day, he ran a place called the Gunsight Academy, which is the biggest gun training place. It's out in by Flagstaff, Arizona. And he came up with this color code, and he talked about condition yellow. He said, when you're in condition yellow, you're paying attention to what's on around you in the world when you're driving, you're walking from your parking lot to the office or whatever it happens to be. Condition white is what just happened, right? And they miss it. And then condition red is protect yourself or get out of there. I think a lot of people are in condition white. Mm-hmm. I mean, I see the guy pull up to the Starbucks or the convenience store and he jump out and leave the keys in the car and go inside to get a cup of coffee. And then they're stunned when somebody steals the car and they go, how could that have happened? And then for kids, I always tell people, especially I do training for like school districts and parents groups and things. I say, tell your kid two things. One, it's okay to come talk to me about scary stuff. If you see some kid bring a gun to work or school or talk about bringing a gun to school, you need to tell me about that. I'm not going to blame you for it. I'm not going to get you in the middle of this, but I'm going to take some action. And the second thing is for kids is when you're in school and you hear or feel some kind of dangerous situation, or you hear about something going to happen, or you hear what sounds like gunshots, get out of there. Yeah. And I think kids sometimes go, well, what was that? And they move towards what's going on.
They want to film it. You know,
exactly. I told my kids, I said, if there's bad people doing bad things at your school, fighting or whatever, get out of there. Yeah. And I think, you know, the biggest challenge we have with schools, kids in terms of school violence is they know about what's going to happen because the kid has leaked what he plans to do, but they don't have the courage to tell a counselor, a teacher, or somebody they trust on the security staff or a school resource officer, or even their parents. And so I think if we can flip that switch, which is, you know, it's not about snitching. It's not about being a tattletale. It's about keeping yourself, you know, safe. But you got to tell me, kid, when these things are happening, so I, as your parent, know what to do and how to contact the school and talk to the, you know, a lot of schools have threat assessment teams now, especially after the Parkland shooting. They're being mandated in states across the country. But you've got to tell me, kid, what this stuff's happening so I know what to do to help you and keep you safe.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Dr. Steve Albrecht, if people out there want to find you, sir, where can they find you?
Yeah, drstevealbrecht.com. It's DR and then Steve and then my last name, Albrecht, ALBRECHT.com. A lot of cool stuff there. I've got some free training videos. There's a lot of free articles and some cool stuff there for businesses to use to do training programs, and all can be found there. And I appreciate the time, Patrick.
Well, I appreciate you coming on, sir, and I would love to have you back on again. We could talk all day. Great conversation. I'd love to have you back on. I will have all your information linked up in the show notes. Any final thoughts before we take off?
Yeah, I think I'm optimistic about the direction we're going in this country in terms of keeping us safe. But it's just a daily struggle where you got to pay attention to your surroundings. And, you know, exactly. You're in law enforcement. You can't wait for the cops to get there. You got to pay attention to what you need to pay attention to yourself.
Yeah, that's a great point. Really quick. And it's such a good point that you just said, Steve, is so many people think that we just get beamed there. The cops just show up immediately.
And that'd be cool.
And, you know, and what we say, and I'm sure you say the same thing to people, you know, you have to take steps, you know, within seconds to make some pretty important decisions before law enforcement gets there.
And I also like people to be a professional witness, be a good information gatherer. So when the cops get there, or you're talking to the 911 dispatcher, you go, this is the direction the guy's going. This is what he's wearing and carrying. All that stuff's really useful. And sometimes people sort of fade out or black out or go red, or they can't remember what they saw. And then it's not useful for the cops. They go, yeah, I don't know what happened.
Yeah.
They're so stunned by the stress of the event.
But I do believe, like you said, I think we're heading in the right direction. Steve Albrecht, thank you so much, sir. Much success to you and your books and everything you're doing out there. You're doing great work, sir.
Thanks, Patrick. Stay safe.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast. For more strategies for self-improvement and resources based on today's episode, be sure to head to cjevolution.com. You can also connect to Patrick directly on social media at @Pat_Fitzgibbons with any questions, comments, or concerns. We look forward to helping you find more personal success on the next episode of the CJ Evolution Podcast.